السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Hey, this is the big picture, and this is A.B. Dauji. So, dear bhaiyo, beno, aur buzruko, you know what? It's great to be back after being away overseas for 2 weeks and ish. How I missed all of you, eh? Did you hear that? Actually, I should rephrase that. How did I miss all of you? And the answer is, not at all. Zero, nothing, zilch, not even an ounce. In the morning when my eyes open, I didn't miss you at all. And after lunch, not a single thought of you came into my head. And the whole afternoon, until the evening, when I put my head on the pillow, did I battle to sleep thinking about you? Not a chance, eh? Slept like a log, like a baby. So, where did I go? It was to wonderful, exotic, vibrant, magical, fascinating Vietnam. What a place, eh? Beautiful beyond words. Spending a night on a large boat with luxury cabins, cruising in picturesque Halong Bay is something to die for, Brazo. Millions of motorbikes swarming through the streets, buzzing like mosquitoes. We had great chow at halal restaurants. The speciality was sticky rice. Sticky rice. It looked like if the mother of the house had to rush to the hospital because her sister was urgently admitted and told the young daughter-in-law to cook the rice for lunch. And when it was eventually dished out for the family, it was a big, mushy, overcooked mess that was difficult to dish out because it got stuck to the spoon. Nobody says a word so as not to make the new daughter-in-law more nervous. And of course, sometimes some people would lie and say, hey, today the food is so tasty and all because Sumaya made it. And she will say, no, I only made the rice. Mom made the dal. Anyway, we had a great time in Vietnam. And now for another incredible tour that's coming up at the end of April. On the 25th, we jet off to magnificent Uzbekistan, the land of Bukhari. Lovely hotels, great guides, and a land rich in Islamic history. 9 seats left. So hurry up and call me. Just Google my name and the number will pop up. Or, if you can remember, 082-352-3526. Hurry for the experience of a lifetime. But before we go off visiting wonderful places overseas, let's visit some local is lekker places, eh? Let me first make some overall statements. Now, you see, all you people in Joburg and Cape Town really think of Durban as something of a, well, second class, as maybe a stepchild or something like that. Johannesburg, as you would say, is where it's at. Where all the action is, all the excitement, the good life is concentrated. That's what you say. And Cape Town? Well, you say it's just too beautiful and the people are so relaxed and laid back. That's the place to live in. That's what the people from Cape Town claim. Well, dear listeners, that, in my view, is a load of manure. That's right. Johannesburg. You want to visit any place there? Any suburb, or even a friend, or a connection, you have to travel a million miles, and the traffic jams, ish. And what have they got? What have they got? Actually, they got their own Indian Ocean. The Zoo Lake. Good heavens. And, okay, let's go to Cape Town. Sure. The wind, and the winter rainfall. You can't get more misery than that. In December, it is no wonder that the Joburgers flock to Durban with half a dozen of their short, fat, red kids, always hungry. Dairy, dairy, take us to the wimpy dairy. Dairy, take us to the... What is dairy? That's where you keep cows, eh? Dairy, take us to the wimpy. And all the restaurants are choked out. Ah, shame, man. You know, I'm just joking. I'm just joking. I really like Joburgers coming to Durban with their short, fat, red kids. I like it. It's good for our economy. And it also proves that Durban is the place, eh? The best city in South Africa. But don't take my word for it, dear listeners. I could be biased. It's actually official. That's right. What's this about, I hear you say? Well, on Wednesday this week, it was reported in our newspapers. Here is the headline. I'm sure you'll like it. Eh? Durban is the most livable city in South Africa. It says here the 20th Mercer Quality of Living Report, released this week, ranked Durban as the most livable city in South Africa. The survey by Mercer is one of the world's most comprehensive and is conducted annually to enable multinational companies and other organizations to compensate employees fairly when placing them on international assignments. So if they are transferring somebody from overseas to a city, then they gauge the livability of that city. And the article says it evaluated the cities according to 39 factors across 10 categories, including the political and social environment, the economic environment, public services and transport, housing, education, recreation, and the natural environment. The data was largely analyzed between September and November 2017, and it will be updated regularly to account for changing circumstances. This year, Mercer also provided a separate ranking on city sanitation, which analyzes cities' waste removal and sewage infrastructure, levels of infectious diseases, air pollution, water availability and quality, all important aspects of a city's attractiveness for both talent and business. Mercer's survey also includes a city infrastructure ranking that assesses each city's supply of electricity, drinking water, telephone and mail services, and public transportation, as well as traffic congestion and the range of international flights available from local airports. I like this part. I love this part here. Durban was placed 89th in the world, Cape Town and Johannesburg 94 and 95 respectively. Oh, yeah, I like it. Well, there you are, folks. And with that official assessment and confirmation about Durban, I think that it is entirely appropriate and justified to say, of course, with great humility, to the Joburgers and Cape Townians, nya, 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 nya. And so, on that note, let's get to the weird and wonderful stories that made it into the media. The zany and the outrageous, sometimes amusing and sometimes shocking. And this first story will really make you fall off your chair. Now, I'm going to tell you a very big secret. Are you ready? Is anybody else listening? No? Okay. I'm going to tell you a big secret. Donald Trump wears a nappy. Yes, that's right. A napkin. I'm not kidding. I never kid. I'm always serious. Here's something else. If he accidentally bumps his head against the furniture in the house, he screams and cries very loudly. His face filled with spit and snot and everything. Very few people know this big secret. Actually, it's not a secret. It's on the Al Jazeera website. And the headline says this: Afghan baby named after infidel Donald Trump. Donald Trump is 18 months old, but posting his photo ID on Facebook triggered a backlash. Donald Trump flops over his pink and white baby walker and rolls it around his family's modest home in Kabul, blissfully unaware of the turmoil his so-called infidel name is causing in Afghanistan. The rosy-cheeked teenager's parents named him after the billionaire U.S. president in the hope of replicating his success. So they called him by that name, thinking that one day, because of his name, he might get rich. But now he is at the center of a social media firestorm in Afghanistan after a photo of his ID papers was posted on Facebook. A self-confessed fan of American tycoon turned leader of U.S., Syed Asadullah Pouya, said he and his wife have been inundated with vulgar and insulting comments attacking their choice of name for their third child. Some Facebook users have gone as far as threatening to kill Syed for giving his son an infidel name, while others have accused him of endangering the boy's life. There are even suggestions Syed is using the name to wangle asylum in the United States, a charge that the 28-year-old teacher vehemently denies. He says, "I don't know at the beginning that Afghan people would be so insensitive about a name," he told AFP, as his son Donald played with a music app on his father's Samsung smartphone in their carpeted room. Syed says someone posted the picture online, sparking the controversy that forced him to close his Facebook account. Donald was born in the central province of Dekundi a few months before the 2016 U.S. presidential elections on the farm where Syed's parents and grandparents grew almonds, wheat, and corn. Syed was inspired to call his son Donald Trump after reading the Persian language version of the businessman's books, including How to Get Rich, which he borrowed from the local library. He says, "I did a lot of research about him, and that motivated me to choose his name for my son." He hopes that his son will be, in his words, as successful, adding that photos of the older Trump already make his young son very happy. But bemusement turned to anger when Syed's parents realized the couple were serious about their name. I wonder what you would think if your son or daughter came and said that they want to name they named the child maybe Jacob Zuma or something. Anyway, the article continues. As relations broke down, the young family moved to Kabul and they are now estranged from their relatives. Their life could not be more difficult from the one enjoyed by the son's namesake, who divides his time between the White House and Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida. The family of five is squeezed into a Spartan room overlooking a small courtyard and outdoor toilet, which they rent for 2,000 Afghanis, which is about $30 a month. While Syed is worried about his family's safety, particularly Donald's safety, he remains stubbornly unrepentant. He says it's likely that he will be harassed or beaten by his classmates. I want to reconsider his name. To hell with the other people. I also wonder whether Donald Trump at the White House has got the same level of mentality as this 18-year-old child. Dear listeners, can you ever find a bigger mampara than this character who named his son Donald Trump? So, what's the likeliest full name? Donald Trump Syed Asadullah Pouya. What if his next child is a girl? Will she be called Theresa May Syed Asadullah Pouya? Actually, I think he should have chosen a better name than the useless Donald Trump. More respectable, something like maybe Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, Syed Asadullah Pouya. Don't you agree? Let me leave it there and turn to a sad story. A sad story. 63-year-old Constantine Reliu is from Romania. 20 years ago, he left Romania to work in Turkey as a chef. In January, he returned home to Romania to make a very shocking discovery. His wife had moved away to Italy, but before she moved, she officially registered that her husband was dead. Listen to this. He has since been living a legalistic nightmare of trying to prove to authorities that he is in fact alive. He faced a major setback on Thursday this week when a court in the northeastern city of Vaslui refused to overturn his death certificate because his request was filed too late, in the words of the court. The decision the court said is final, meaning he's dead. He says, I am a living ghost. I'm a living ghost. I'm officially dead, although I'm alive. I have no income. And because I am listed as dead, I can't do anything. During the interview, Relio was deeply emotional, starting off by saying, I think I'm going to cry. And going on to voice rage and desire for revenge against his wife, who now lives in Italy. But he can't find her. He doesn't know. Nobody knows where she is. Shame, man. I feel so sorry for this guy. His photo is in the article, and it shows him as a bicharo, a broken man. Imagine when he applies for a job and he's told, sorry, you can't, we can't employ you, you are dead. Sad indeed, very sad. But you know what? There are some fellows here in Durban who seem to be totally dead. Waiters in some restaurants, sure. Ask them for a sauce and you would be lucky if you get it after you finish your chow. But here's a quick one. You could get a fine if you drive without putting on your seatbelt, that we all know. You could get a big fine if you speak on the cell while driving. You could get thrown out of a restaurant if you smoke in a non-smoking area. Well, latest news. New York is considering a law that would ban people from smoking while walking. The proposed fine is $50. Well, the theory is that if you smoke while walking, the people behind you will be affected by the smoke. This got me thinking, what if you take, say, 20 steps, stop and take a few puffs, and then walk another 20 steps and stop and take another couple of puffs? Technically, you are not smoking while walking, correct? And I thought a little further. Here, the cops are battling to get crime under control. Battling. Bag snatches and hijackings and cell phone grabbing and wallets taken at gunpoint and at knife point. But in New York, the cops will watch out for a person committing the dangerous crime of walking while smoking. Hey, we live in a really wonderful world. Hey, hey. All right, let me see what else I've got. 3 minutes before the news headlines. Or the ad break, I've been told. 3 minutes before the ad break. Let me see what else I can cover. All right, let me just go quickly through this one here. You know, I don't normally comment on local politics, but I'm sure that all of you breathed a collective sigh of relief yesterday when you heard that the ratings agency Moody's has now downgraded us. Well, actually, no, I don't get a shock. I should have said Moody's has not downgraded us, not downgraded us. In fact, the good news is that it raised our credit rating from negative to stable. Whew. And it says, in its own words, the previous weakening of national institutions was gradually reversing, which supported an economic recovery. Sure. That's a lot of words, eh? The previous weakening of national institutions was gradually reversing, which supported an economic recovery. That's a lot of words. I wonder what they mean. Maybe they are trying to say that now that the Chorwan rats under Zuma are desperately trying to run but cannot hide, Tronk is where they will end up. And also, most commentators have been saying that our new president is working slowly but surely to take out the weeds from the government. He can't do it all at once because Yakubai's supporters are still in the government, and maybe one by one, in due course, will get their heads chopped off by the state capture inquiry. So he doesn't have to do anything now. Just wait and see. Things will take their course. And ratings agencies see him as a tough guy. And you know what? I got a new name for him. Remember, you heard it first on The Big Picture. You heard it first on The Big Picture. His new name is Ramaphosa. Yes, Ramaphosa. You like it? Huh? Don't forget to pay me copyright royalties every time you use it, okay? But he must act to reduce the size of the cabinet. He has to reduce the size of the cabinet. What is it now? I think he's standing at about 35 ministers, right? All collecting nice fat salaries and all the perks, big Mercedes and official homes and lots of other things. And after they leave, they still get huge pensions and free flights and everything else. The bill for these top boys is huge, huge. You know, I always think about this. Remember the good old days of the struggle, all those activists, those guys who were in the UDF and everywhere, long hair, driving VW Beetles with flowers painted all over them, singing Bob Dylan songs about freedom and so on. They were so committed to work for the people selflessly, humanitarian reasons. That's what they were doing, nothing else, for the people only. Not long ago, after 94, I was outside the city hall here in Durban. A big black limo pitched up in front of the city hall. One of these activists was in the back seat. I waited. The driver got out and went to the other side. Well, this guy wasn't an activist. He was a top politician. The driver got out and went to the other side and opened the door for him. He stepped out with an important look on his face. I thought, wow, hey, when you become a big shot politician, then shame, man. Ah, shame. Your arm becomes paralyzed. You can't even open the door for yourself. What a dangerous job this is, eh? Arms get paralyzed. Since then, I also thought, hey, you know what? The white MPs in the apartheid government paid themselves massive salaries. They could do that because the country's resources were spent on the whites and very, very little on the blacks. So all the collective money that came out was spent on salaries and everything else for the white. It was disproportionate. It was, of course, exploitation. So when the new government came in 94, they walked right into these grossly inflated salaries. Shouldn't they be adjusted downwards? This is what I've been thinking. Reduced considerably, but no. And today, that collective bill paid to MPs and ministers is incredibly high. All this while children drown in pit toilets. This is so sad. Makes me so angry. What a way for a five-year-old to die. Eh? What a way for a five-year-old child to die. Drown in a pool of crap. It's sick. It should not happen. How much does it cost to build a simple basic toilet? Just one toilet out of, say, blocks. 10 grand? Huh? 20 grand? Let us determine how many pit toilets could be built out of the money from state capture. How many pit toilets equals $200 million stolen from the Estina Dairy project? And so I think we should use the pit toilet as a measure, a fixed factor against money stolen or wasted. How many pit toilets would you get from Zuma's 15.3 million rands legal bill and so on? Little children drowning in crap while the Chorwan politicians are drowning in luxury. Let us pray that the smiling Ramaphosa delivers some sharp kicks up the backsides of these rats who steal taxpayers' money. They are no different from those who mug us in the streets or break into your homes. That's my say on that. Time for an ad break. Right. Welcome back. It's the big picture. Right. Okay, let's get into some very serious stuff. Okay, serious business. Now, over time, I have come across some very shocking stories about prominent Muslims being subjected to harassment and gross, gross injustice. Many years ago, I spoke about the plight of Sheikh Umar Abdul Rahman. He became blind when he was still a baby, but later in life became a very outspoken Sheikh, a Maulana, who was feared and sometimes courted by the regime in Egypt under Sadat and then later on under Mubarak. But he was regarded as a dangerous nuisance, and just before he was due to be arrested for the umpteenth time, he moved to the United States, to New York, in fact, and was imam at a masjid. He was still outspoken, but not against the U.S., but against his home country, Egypt, and its corrupt regime. And tapes of his speeches were smuggled to his people, where he had a very huge following. Not good for the dictator Mubarak, who was a friend of the United States. So the United States arrested Sheikh Umar Abdul Rahman and charged him under a law from about 100 years ago, under which nobody else was charged. And it was the name of the law was seditious conspiracy. That's what he was charged for, meaning that his words in the masjid had the bayan that he delivered somehow inspired some musallis to plan acts of terrorism. It was all a setup. It was all a lie. The trial lasted about 2 or 3 years, and no bail for the sheikh, of course. Eventually, was found guilty and was given a very, very long sentence. Blind, suffering from chronic diabetes, serious heart problems, asthma and so on. And eventually he died in prison about a year or two ago. So there you are. This whole trial took place around 1991-92. So he's been in jail from that time. Sheikh Umar Abdul Rahman, a victim of American injustice. That is what I called my coverage, my program every week on radio as the trial unfolded. I must find the tape somewhere and play them here on this program sometime, inshallah. Muslims who speak out are targeted. Professor Sami Al-Aryan, his case is equally shocking. He was a respected lecturer in Florida, in the United States, but he spoke against the He spoke about the plight of the Palestinians and so the supporters of Israel targeted him and he was arrested. A very long trial followed and he was jailed. And he was deported eventually after a very long time. I'm in touch with him. He is now in Istanbul, Turkey. And inshallah next week we will listen to him and the ordeal that he underwent. And here's the point. Here's the point. The so-called West boasts, hey, prides itself that it stands for freedom and justice and free speech and human rights and so on. You know, as you enter New York, you encounter the Statue of Liberty. It is a monument, in my view, to hypocrisy. Liberty, my foot. As the members of the Holy Land Foundation, who are now in jail for committing no crime, decent, caring, wonderful human beings whose only commitment was to ease the suffering of the Palestinians. A charity organization, that's what it is, the Holy Land Foundation. Well, there are people who don't like, there are people in America who don't like that. You mustn't support the Palestinians in any way, even through charity, humanitarian aid and so on. So trumped up charges were laid and now these decent, caring human beings are in jail. Prominent people. It's a travesty. That's what it is. Travesty. An injustice. Maybe I'll speak about them next week also, inshallah. Can anyone guess who, can anyone guess where the Statue of Liberty came from? Anyone put your hands up, please? No? No? No one? Sure. And I always thought that you people are so clever, eh? The Statue of Liberty at the entrance of New York Harbor was a gift from the people of France to the people of the United States, dedicated on October 28, 1886. Well, there you are, ladies. When the bully comes home from work, at lunchtime when he's taken a mouthful of akne, tell him casually, honey, or whatever name you call him, sugar or sweetie. Hey, that's not a very those are not very healthy sounding names, eh? Especially with the widespread increase of diabetes. Anyway, whatever it is, maybe Janu or something like that, say to him, you know, I was watching CNN and saw the Statue of Liberty. It is so high, 93 meters, eh? And France gave it as a present to America. Well, I can guarantee you the bully is sure to choke on his rice and look at you sideways wondering what happened to you today. Nice to make him nervous, eh? Anyway, France. Ah, France, and the great French Revolution against tyranny that gave us the slogan, Libertaire, Égalitaire, Fraternitaire. How's my French, eh? Coming right from the gullet. Libertaire, Égalitaire, Fraternitaire. Meaning, of course, liberty, equality, and fraternity. Brotherhood, fraternity, brotherhood. Wonderful stuff, I like it. From the land of frog's legs and croissants. What a great place. Like America, freedom, justice, human rights, freedom of speech, freedom of religion. But not for one man. No, 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 no. Not for one man. Tariq Ramadan, a Muslim. Listen to this. I'm going to quote part of a brilliant article, a very long article, in fact. We'll see how far we can go, about the plight, the suffering, the injustice suffered by this man, Tariq Ramadan. Some of you know him very well. He came to South Africa a few times. Some may have read about him and some may not know him at all. Well, it's time to know Tariq Ramadan. So let's see how far we can go in the time we have. The article is entitled, The Tariq Ramadan case, a comprehensive review by Alain Gabon. He's a French citizen and associate professor of French studies based in the United States. He's the head of the Department of Foreign Languages and Literature at Virginia Wesleyan University and has written numerous papers and articles. Anyway, very prominent professor. And he says, Tariq Ramadan, Europe's most influential Muslim intellectual and an international Islamic institution all by himself. I like that. Eh? All by himself, he's an international Islamic institution. Has been in preventative detention and solitary confinement in France since February 2nd, 2018. Ramadan's incarceration followed two charges of rape, allegations he has fully denied, calling them a smear campaign coordinated by his old French enemies. Due to inadequate medical care in Fleury-Mérogis prison, Ramadan has multiple sclerosis and another neurobiological disease that requires substantial daily treatment. His health has rapidly deteriorated in jail. It was in an ambulance under medical escort that he arrived to his first appeal hearing in court. On February 17th, we learned from Agence France-Presse news agency, the news released that Ramadan's first medical examination in prison concluded that his health condition was incompatible with detention. That means he shouldn't be in jail. The medical document specified, this is what it said, since his arrival, this patient has been experiencing unbearable pain in his lower limbs with permanent sensory trouble, for which the treatments available in jail are drastically insufficient. This official document directly corroborated assessments by Ramadan's private physicians, one in London, the other in Geneva. He's actually, he lives in Switzerland. That's where he's located. But now he came to France, jailed him. Well, despite this, the judge decided, after all these medical reports and everything, the judge decided to prolong Ramadan's detention and solitary confinement. Further, his wife and children were again denied visitation rights with neither explanation nor justification, a radical measure that falls well outside of French judicial norms, as even confirmed murderers are routinely granted visitation rights. Even murderers are allowed visits from their family, from their wife or children. For these reasons, the handling of Tariq Ramadan's case involves not only the denial of basic legal rights. How could anyone properly prepare a legal defense in such conditions? It also represents a case of human rights abuses. This being said, none of what follows implies in any way that Ramadan is either innocent or guilty. So this writer is not saying, and neither am I, whether Ramadan is innocent or guilty of the charge. And the author says it is actually important that the accusations of Henda Ayari and there's a pseudonym here, Christel, have been fully considered and heard empathically by all media, the courts included, although one may question how they are already being treated as proven facts. That means the media is covering it as if he really committed the rapes. While allegations of rape are frequently discarded or taken lightly, this case has demonstrated a rare exception to the rule. The charges against Ramadan have become the center of global attention for Islamists, Islamophobes, and everyone in between. This article is very long. It's a very interesting, captivating, really. I was reading it there on the plane while we were flying on a domestic flight in Vietnam. Very long article. I can send it to you, no problem, very easy. Google my name and you can see, you find my email and phone number popping up. Or you can send me a message at abie@iafrica.com. abie@iafrica.com. And if you can remember the phone number, 082-352-3526. And if you want the newsletter, which I send out frequently, the RAIN newsletter, then just give me a full name and drop me a line and say you want the newsletter. So let's see how much I can do in the limited time. The passions, it says, in order to understand the Ramadan case, it is essential to contextualize it without assuming either innocence or guilt. Well, I just read that. The passions around Ramadan, both positive, positive and negative, friendly and hostile, admiring and heinous, are most intense in France. For this reason, it may be surprising for a non-French audience to witness the combination of contradictory emotions and reactions elicited by the Swiss Islamic intellectual. On the one hand, the immense clout, awe, gratitude and admiration he has for years enjoyed in France among much of the Muslim youth, and many of the not so young as well, especially the so-called re-Islamicized third generation, which often gravitates around the Union of French Islamic Organization, France's biggest umbrella. Anyway, let me just skip through some of the things and see what else I got for you. Now, about the article says that he's got very, very powerful adversaries, enemies, even in the French government, even the presidents, Sarkozy and all of them spoke very strongly against Ramadan. Ramadan is so articulate. You feel like listening to him the whole day. A great intellectual. And here's one statement that Ramadan made. And it's a very powerful message. He says, in the 1990s, Tariq Ramadan attracted a following among French Muslims, both in the, I don't know what's the belles, that is the townships, and in the professional middle classes. His message was simple, revolutionary, and electrifying. Islam was already a part of France, and so Muslim citizens were under no obligation to choose between their identities. They could practice their faith freely, even strictly, and still be French, so long as they respected the country's laws. French Muslims, he argued, should overcome their victim mentality and embrace both their faith and their Frenchness. By the same token, France should recognize that Islam is a French faith. Muslim citizens are scarcely in need of assimilation into a country to which they already belong. A paternalistic notion with roots in France's colonial history. Let me just go quickly to the charges and some of the statements that were made by these two so-called witnesses or the people who claim to be raped. It says here, in a further aggravation of these legal injustices, on December 6, 2017, Ramadan's lawyers filed a key piece of evidence with the Paris prosecutor's office. This legal item was actually Ramadan's hard alibi against one of the two charges. It contained several documents, listen carefully, it contained several documents including a London to Lyon plane ticket showing that around the time the second accuser, with the anonymous name Christelle, when she stated that Ramadan was raping her in his Lyon hotel room shortly before a conference, the man was not even on French soil. Ramadan wasn't even in France, according to the flight ticket. If formally validated, this may have called into question at least one of the women's accounts. The problem, however, is that this crucial piece of evidence, Ramadan's hard alibi for one of the two cases, was lost. And the prosecutor lost it somehow. It disappeared for 2 months while the investigation was being conducted. It was only on February 1st, 2018, that Ramadan's lawyers realized that this most important piece of evidence had actually been added to the court file. It was not added to the court file. Now, the other one, let's see if you can find that one. The long and short of the story is that both of these accusers, those who accused him of raping them, were very close to some right-wing anti-Islamic, in other words, Islamophobes like Fiametta Venner, whom they called hundreds of times, as phone records demonstrate. Fiametta Venner is the founder, manager of an anti-Islamic website known as Ikhwan Info, which is a conspiracist blog dedicated to exposing the Islamization of Europe and the so-called global Islamic plot. So these women were in touch with her. Even more troubling, it appears that Christelle may be using forged evidence. After losing her cell phone, which supposedly contained incriminating evidence, she lost it for 3 months. Then she claimed to have found it, and she then showed a text thread between her and Ramadan on the talk show. Anyway, the most startling thing is that He's supposed to have raped them many, many years ago. But after that, wait, let me just read this. Henda Ayari declared to the press that she had a sexual relationship with Ramadan for at least a year, and that in June 2013, 15 months after her alleged rape, she herself attempted to resume a relationship with him. So both these women, after the alleged rape, one was in 2013, then they still tried to stalk him on Facebook, and he had to close the Facebook account and delete them. But yet, they still said, let's meet, come, let's... And one of the women said that he must stop blocking her, and so on. So I'm just paraphrasing some of the things. While Ayari testified having finally stopped all attempts to contact Ramadan in mid-2013, Ramadan's lawyers uncovered and formally submitted nearly 300 emails sent by Ayari to Ramadan between June and August 2014. So if these women claimed to be raped, why were they so desperate to resume friendship with him? 300 emails saying, please, we want to meet you, and so on. So there you are. He is in jail. He is extremely sick. He should be out on bail at least. The trial should take its course. But already they are all these false claims are being shown up. So I would urge you, dear listeners, to follow this case very, very closely. One of the leading scholars of Europe, one of the leading scholars, Tariq Ramadan, is subjected to harassment and possible a lengthy jail sentence. All cooked up, of course, cooked up. We are out of time. Had a lot to speak about. We are out of time. Well, for this hour, we are out of time. And on another radio station, we'll resume after the news. But what have we got for you? Light at the end of the tunnel. Well, you know, I'm a little bit jet-lagged. Finish, kaputs, babalazd, still. It was a 16-hour trip from, where was it now? Saigon, through Hong Kong. 16-hour trip altogether. Wrecked. Kalas. So I'm going to recycle some old ones. I hope you forgot this one. Ronnie from Mirbank was in ICU once again at Claywood Hospital. His head was cracked. And he had a huge bandage around it. And all kinds of tubes were attached to him. And his dear friend, Gulambai went to visit him. Hey, Ronnie. Hey, man, you look so bad. What happened to you? And Ronnie battled to answer him. Hey, Gulu. What I must tell you, man, my Fru Pushpa whacked me with the heavy iron frying pan again. Whacked me on the head. Gulambai said, so what happened this time? Eh? What happened this time and all? And Ronnie replied, hey, Gulu, I was sitting in the lounge, checking TV. My light is silver. He came and he asked me, Dad, tell me, how were people born? So I answered him, I said, you see, son, you see, Adam and Eve made babies, then their babies became adults and made babies, and so on. Anyway, Shiva then went into the kitchen and was talking to Pushpa. Then he came back into the lounge and he said to me, Dad, you didn't tell me the truth. Ma says we were monkeys first. And then gradually, we evolved to become what we are now. So I laughed and told Shiva, my boy, your mother was speaking about her side of the family. Hey, next minute I woke up in hospital bed. This is A.B. Dawji bidding you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And on the flip side of the news, there'll be more of this on another radio station.